Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. Today we are honored to have as a guest on our program the distinguished writer Thomas Goodrich, author of Hellstorm, Scalp Dance, Rape, Hate, Sex and Violence in War and Peace, and his new book, Summer 1945, Germany, Japan, and the Harvest of Hate, and more than a dozen important books in total, as well as authoring hundreds of published articles. Mr. Goodrich is a graduate of Washburn University, where he majored in history, and history has been the focus of his writing. I recently discovered that he's a vegan, as am I. Before he wrote Hellstorm and became a racial nationalist, he was interviewed on scores of major radio and television stations and networks and was a featured speaker on C-SPAN, was featured as a guest in numerous documentaries on PBS, as well as on the History, Discovery, and National Geographic channels. He's spoken before service organizations and historical groups across the nation. And may I add, Mr. Goodrich is a powerful writer. His research convinces and impresses the intellect, and his words hit you in the gut with as much punch as Raymond Chandler's, a rare combination. Welcome to the program, Tom.
Kevin, my pleasure being here.
I remember being about 12 years old, which for me would have been about 1968, and having one of my friends at school tell me how he'd like to go back in time 25 years to World War II Germany. He said, those Germans just didn't know how evil their country was. They weren't told. They didn't know about how their soldiers were being used for evil purposes, to slaughter innocent people, to take over other people's countries, to commit atrocities, to burn babies alive and burn people in ovens. If I could go back in time, I could tell the ordinary Germans about all this evil, and then maybe they would stop supporting their evil leaders, their evil establishment. Maybe they could have stopped most of that killing and most of that torture of innocent people and most of that genocide before it happened. Well, I know now that my friend got a lot of things wrong. He was the one who was propagandized. But he had an interesting idea. He wanted to be a sentinel of truth to stop an evil, lying, murderous establishment. Maybe the American people, I think now, desperately need a sentinel of truth too, to get them to see all the evil and stop all the evil that comes from the regime in Washington. And maybe we actually do have a sentinel of truth right now, though most Americans don't know it. And maybe, Tom, that sentinel of truth is you.
Well, after I catch my breath, Kevin, I'm going to say that's probably one of the nicest introductions I have ever received anywhere. I as you can see, I'm at a loss for words right now. I'm not sure I can quite live up to that. I will do everything in my power to live up to that. But back to your friend at the time, I'm not sure what to say about someone like that. He had everything wrong. You're right, though. We do need these type of people, but we need to, for them to get their facts straight. Obviously, he did not. He had them all wrong. I don't think any Jewish organization could help from getting up and giving him a standing ovation for all the propaganda he has absorbed into his very being, into his bloodstream. I just hope he doesn't have any children. I'm very serious about that. We do not need to pass on that sort of DNA that so mindlessly, so brainlessly accepts such vile, vulgar propaganda, especially in this day and age when we have the internet. And he can find out all the knowledge that ever was with a mere finger tap of that mouse. And yet, if this was recent, when he said that, shame, shame, shame on him for being so utterly lazy and ignorant.
No, it's been 50 years ago, Tom.
So
maybe he's found the truth. I've lost touch with the guy. But I was propagandized, too, back in 1968, and I found the truth. So maybe there's hope.
our epiphany occurred roughly at about the same time, I would say, 68. Maybe a little before that for me. But then all I said about your friend of 50 years ago, that stands to reason, because that was what the general feeling was among at least Americans and probably most Europeans at the time. Now there's no excuse. And I'd like to think if you could talk to your friend today, he might be a different sort of person altogether. Perhaps he did click that mouse. Perhaps he did find out the truth for himself. And perhaps now he's spreading that truth. I don't know. There's so many people that we probably both know who have changed radically in the last few years alone. And I'm happy to say I'm in contact with many of those people who are red pilling, as the term goes today, who are doing that. And we're on our way to winning this thing, Kevin. You're in a good position. I'm in a good position to know what I'm talking about. We're in a very good position to win this thing, and not later, but sooner. And people like your friend of 50 years ago, maybe now I'm hoping he did have some children, because he will at least pass on this certain militancy.
Yes.
to find the truth and then spread the truth, the knowledge. But again, my friend, thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. Let's see if I can live up to it with this interview.
Well, tell me about your latest book, Summer 1945. It's the immediate aftermath of World War II in Europe and the last throes of war in the Pacific. What drew you to that subject, and why did you write the book?
Originally, Kevin, it was intended to be a book solely about Japan. I was doing some research. I knew from the research I was doing that the story we've been told about the Pacific War of World War II was askew, to put it mildly, and radically false. The book was supposed to be based around mostly the island fighting, and then, of course, the attacks upon Japan, the home islands itself, and, of course, the atomic bombing of Japan. But the problem was, I could not find any testimony from individuals, that is, Japanese, who fought on the islands, because virtually all of them were killed, either in combat or murdered after surrender. And it's very difficult to give what they were thinking, to write down and put into a history book what they were thinking, when there's nobody to pass on those thoughts to me. It's very simple. It's very fundamental. And so I realized that I would have to do something else for this to be a book. And I thought, well, wait a minute. I've written Hellstorm. There's a lot of things I couldn't get in Hellstorm because I didn't know it at the time I wrote Hellstorm. Mm-hmm. And there were some other things that I did some deeper research and found out. And I said, well, let's think about this. How about summer 1945? Technically, the first summer of peace for Germany, of course. It was not peace. It was war by another name. And the last summer of horrendous, nightmarish war for Japan. How about something like this, I thought. Two allies fighting against the same foe, that is the American and the British. In Japan's case, the Australians also added to the picture. How about back and forth? How about showing what was going on in Germany at the same time that it was going on in Japan, and go back and forth and see if there's any difference in it? And virtually there was none. In fact, if anything, the so-called peace in Germany during that summer was worse than the war for Germany, if anything. And of course, Japan, that's a story all unto itself. In fact, just before we started talking, I was working on an article I'm going to submit about, the name is called Dirty Japs, and our carbon dating is similar, I think, and we both grew up with this idea that the Japs were subhumans, they were sneaky, they attacked us without provocation at Pearl Harbor, and when we started fighting them, they would do things like act like they were surrendering at the same time they pulled the pin on a grenade and blew up innocent American GIs and Marines. We grew up with this notion that the Japs were, and it's still hard for me to shake that term Japs, because mm-hmm. that's what I grew up with. We both grew up with them on TV and the movies and their diabolical, their terrible ways of fighting and living. almost from the first hour that I started researching the Japanese part of this book, I had to suddenly start casting off, shedding like a snake might their skin, about what I thought I knew about the Japanese. Virtually everything I thought I knew about the Japanese was wrong. It was lies. It was propaganda that had been passed down and accepted so eagerly by people like kids like us.
Sure, I remember that too. I remember advertisements in old magazines that my parents had around the house that literally depicted Japanese people as these little demon monster beings with gigantic teeth and huge glasses and claws. And there was even one advertisement, believe it or not, for a company that sold ceramic insulators, believe it or not. And they were so proud that their insulators were used in the B-29 bombers that were, quote, blasting and roasting Japs, close quote. That's an ad in a major magazine, a major American magazine.
Mm-hmm. And all the TVs and all the movie portrayals of the Japanese, perhaps even to this day, still portray the Japanese as something other than human in the way they fight. I just saw something the other night. It was about the Battle of Okinawa, and so help me, I can't think of the name of the movie. But it still the lies continue. Even in that movie, they were treacherous people and they were something to be destroyed utterly. Well, after I got doing the research in the book, first of all, I think all of your listeners understand what Pearl Harbor was really all about. I won't get into that too much. It was a vicious false flag staged operation to drag the Japanese into the war and allow America to enter the war they really wanted to get into in Europe via the back door. And
yes,
of course, FDR and his Jewish henchmen all around him, Henry Morgenthau, Henry Dexter White, Bernard Baruch, people like that, helped him engineer this false flag event at Pearl Harbor. The Americans did everything in their power to goad the Japanese into doing something radical. The Japanese refused. They did not do a thing, even though we had American warships patrolling their waters, looking to, hoping the Japanese would attack, do something to give them the excuse to enter this war, the European war, that is, via the back door. The Japanese were finally obliged to attack at Pearl Harbor. It was either that or continue as it was and lose their entire nation. All the industrial power they had worked for, the strength to give it all up, basically, and surrender. Japanese decided to, hey, look, if we're going to lose this against a large, powerful, vastly more superior nation than ours, then at least let's fight. Maybe we can win this in the short term and force them to give it up, this what they're trying to do to us right now. But the sneak attack at Pearl Harbor, this day that shall live in infamy, of course, it worked perfectly for FDR's plans. And let's face it, the Jews were in control of all forms of communication at the time, and what they said went, basically the radio, the newspapers. And if it was a sneak attack, then it was going to be a sneak attack for all Americans. And the Americans, not just their sons who fought in the war, also hated the Japanese to the nth degree. I mean, their hatred is unbelievable if you read some of the accounts from civilians at the time. So with that said, and the declaration of war, America's declaration of war against Japan, then all that was left was to fight. And of course, after America got into the war and after Germany, adhering to its defense treaty with Japan, declared war on America, of course, America turned its attention toward Europe. And from that point on until roughly 1944, America's almost full attention was focused on Europe and winning that war to destroy Nazism, form of government that actually raised its head against Jewish power, the power structure throughout the world. And once that was out of the way, then they could turn their attention to Japan, which they did. And Japan knew that they were up against a an incredible giant, that they're in no way could they compete with the Americans in the long term. They understood that. And when the Americans finally did turn their attention toward Japan, all of its might and weight, it was over in relatively quick time, actually. But this hatred of the Japanese, this hatred that it worked its way down from FDR all the way down to the man in the streets. It was shared, of course, by the sons who eagerly joined the Marine Corps and the Army. And by the way, my biological father was one of those people who joined the Marine Corps to fight mm-hmm. the Japs. And it was from beginning to end, from that first fight on Guadalcanal, the first island we invaded, all the way to the end, all the way to the attack on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It was no quarter. Black flag type of war. If the Japs, if they won, they lived. If they lost, they died. It was as simple as that. One Marine colonel, as the landing party in their boats just before they landed, he said, "You will kill every son of a bitch, every yellow son of a bitch you meet, and that's it. No prisoners," basically that. And that was the de facto rules of war against the Japanese, that you will take no prisoners. Simple.
Wow.
And that's the way it went, all the way to the end. And that's one of the problems I had with the research of the book. I could not find any testimony from survivors. You might look back and think, when was the last time you saw Japanese faces behind barbed wire, that is, in a concentration camp over there?
I never have.
Yes, that's true, because there weren't any. They were killing everyone. And that sounds preposterous, but one of the things I had to avoid or had to accept was that the Japanese, this idea that the Japanese will never surrender. They were willing to fight for the emperor to the death. They will never surrender. They'll commit suicide before they do. Well, after a while, okay, on Guadalcanal, some of the first accounts I've got by Americans, of course, are Japanese coming out of the woods with their hands up and no weapon in sight, trying to surrender, because after the fight proceeded for several weeks, the Japanese realized, we've lost. We're going to lose this island. And Japanese, I could find no appreciable difference in emotions to the American, average American soldier. In other words, they wanted to live.
Mm-hmm.
Far from this idea that Japanese lived to die. That's nonsense. They all wanted to live. The few letters that did get home, I've read these things, and they all dreamed of going back and when the war was over, hopefully victoriously, but when the war was over, going back and marrying that girl that they wanted to marry, raising a family, having pets, rearing a garden, just getting on with life. But when they first saw the Americans were massacring all who tried to surrender, and don't forget, a lot of the Japanese soldiers watched breathlessly from the tree line, watching their comrades try to surrender to the Americans, only to see them being slaughtered by machine guns. And worse than that, being watching while the Americans tortured and chopped up the bodies of those who weren't quite dead yet. That was another thing that went on until the end of the war. Was the deliberate mutilation of Japanese bodies, cutting off ears, noses, cutting out eyeballs, cutting penises off and sticking them in the mouth of the dying, throwing some of the wounded in with the dead and then covering them up. In other words, burying them alive, watching them kick the gold teeth out of the mouths of others who are laying there suffering.
Seeing that from the tree line must certainly have sharpened the resolve of a soldier to carry on and fight no matter what the odds.
Precisely. And this went on, and they could see what was going on. And of course, what would anybody think in that situation? They'd think, well, to hell with this. I'm not about to surrender and go through that. I mean, it's terrible. It's horrible. I mean, it's what anybody would think. It's what the American soldiers on the plains, when they were fighting the American Indians, the so-called peaceful, pastoral American Indians, when It's what they thought also when they saw what happened to their comrades. There's no surrender. Save the last bullet for yourself if necessary, but you cannot surrender in this war. And that's the same way the Japanese soldier felt. So that's how we get this idea that they lived to die, that they fought to the death, that they liked dying. And in a short term, they would, when everything came apart, they would kill themselves. Well, there's a very good reason for all that too. Yes, they had to. There was no other choice.
You've been listening to part one of American Evil, an interview with Thomas Goodrich. Be with us again next time for part two, right here on American Dissident Voices. You've been listening to American Dissident Voices, the radio program of the National Alliance. The National Alliance is working to educate white men and women around the world as to the nature of the reality we must face, and organizing our people to ensure our survival and advancement. We very much need your help to continue. It is almost impossible in today's environment for those who advocate for our race to have an ordinary source of income. Keep us publishing. Keep us on the air. Keep us advocating for you by sending your contribution to National Alliance, Box 4, Mountain City, Tennessee, 37683, USA. Or help us by visiting natall.com/donate. That's natall.com/donate. Once again, our postal address is Box 4, Mountain City, Tennessee, 37683, USA. Until next week, this is Kevin Alfred Strom reminding you to do right and fear no one.
For blood and for soil, we will work, we will toil. Heaven is born on the earth. The heroes arise as we shout to the skies. We will now have our rebirth. For blood and for soil, we will work, we will toil. Heaven is born on the earth. shall.